clean air. You would think it would be a no-brainer, but it took an act of Congress to make it a law. There are 20 coal-fired power plants in Missouri, and they expose more than 4.7 million people who live within a 30-mile radius to their exhaust. In Kansas, there are 8 coal-fired power plants. It's been almost 50 years since the Clean Air Act was made into law, and this November, a series of talks will begin throughout the nation seeking public input into how best to reduce carbon emissions from existing power plants. I'm Steven Steigman, and on today's Central Standard, we take a look at the Clean Air Act, climate change, and a little bit later in the hour, we'll explore the changing nature of small towns in America. That's ahead, right after this news. This is Central Standard. I'm Steven Steigman. The Clean Air Act was first developed around the same time as the Civil Rights Movement, but it wasn't until the 1970s that the federal government developed regulations designed to monitor and enforce air quality laws. And 50 years later, the Clean Air Act is still very much alive, like recent regulations of greenhouse gases coming from cars and power plants. Clean Air Act is our topic today, and joining us is Carl Brooks. He's the Regional Administrator for Region 7 of the EPA. Mr. Brooks, welcome to the program.
Stephen, thanks. Pleasure to be with you.
And Caroline Davies is the Program Director for UMKC's Environmental Studies Program. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Wonderful to be here.
Let's start with you, Carl Brooks. What is the Clean Air Act, and why is the EPA inviting public input into it now?
Well, the Clean Air Act is probably one of this nation's most successful public health protection laws in our history. The Congress enacted it, as you said, over 40 years ago as a way to control the pollutants that are emitted from stationary sources like power plants and from cars and trucks. It gives EPA responsibility to set health standards to control pollutants, and then the states take on the really important job of issuing permits for stationary standards. So it's a shared responsibility between the national government and the states. And the track record, if you look back at it in terms of lives saved, healthier lives, property protected, it's been a tremendous success. We're taking a look now at carbon pollution because starting about 5 years ago, the United States Supreme Court held that greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide are pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and therefore EPA has the power and the duty to control their emission. And there are good reasons for doing that. We can talk more this morning about a listening session that's coming up here in the Kansas City area on Monday, November 4.
We'll do that a little bit later in the program, but let's step back a little bit in history here. The Clean Air Act was passed in 1963. Professor Davies, tell us about air quality back in the 1960s. What set in motion the Clean Air Act?
Generally, lots of pollution, unregulated, completely unregulated, putting pollution up into the air. That pollution includes not only CO2, but sulfur, which results in acid rain, particulates, heavy metals, mercury, a number of other heavy metals. And those, when they come down, are breathed, and they're also put into the water and our other ecological systems.
Take us back to the 60s, and let's pretend that we were to walk outside right now onto Troost Avenue. What would the air, especially on a rainy day, a really humid day, what would the air be like? Carl Brooks, do you want to explain for us what that air would have been like?
Well, sure. The best I can do would be to say pull out an old black and white photograph of Kansas City from the 1950s or 60s and notice how little visibility there is. Almost all electricity was generated from burning coal. People still heated offices and factories with coal. And that coal pollution descended down into the river valley here. And just take a look at old buildings that haven't been cleaned up. You can literally see visible evidence of the pollution that was going into our bodies. And as Caroline said, into the waters around us. You probably would have smelled the air, too. Anybody who's visited places with less advanced economics than ours, you can smell the air. Mm-hmm. And so you could have smelled Kansas City air 50 years ago on a day like this.
What's supposed to be in our air? Like
I'll defer to the scientists there, okay. But I maybe could contribute a bit.
Well, because we can't see the air, it's clear to us. You don't see the gases that are there. The largest component of the atmosphere is nitrogen, not oxygen. There are natural particulates. We have dust particles. In order to get precipitation, moisture has to condense around some kind of microparticle. So there are particles in the air. It's not as if the air is very, very pure. Those dust particles tended to be mineral, and rain will condense around anything, including a sulfur particle, which is how you get acid rain.
Well, then let's talk about some of the negative health risks and repercussions from pollutants in the air. Tell us a little bit about that.
Certainly asthma is one of those, COPD, respiratory issues. I don't think a lot of people are aware that not long ago, Kansas City, St. Louis were in the top of the nation for childhood asthma. You wouldn't think of the Midwest as being one of the highest, number two in the nation. Not now, but a decade ago. And so childhood asthma, why is it here that we have it? Anytime that you have a valley, things tend to settle, but also because we also have more lane miles than most places. We have trains, planes, and lots and lots and lots of cars.
So even though EPA regulations, Clean Air Act regulations are in place, you would suspect that there would be a drop in the cases of asthma over decades, but we're seeing instead a rise in cases. Mm-hmm. Explain that. Yeah. Is it because there's just more density and reasons like that?
Asthma's complicated, and it's another show.
Right,
I know you've
right,
had
yes.
it because it's multimodal. In the spring, you have tree pollens. In the summer, you have ground level ozone, which is definitely related to this conversation and putting out exhaust from automobiles. In the fall, it's other kinds of weed pollens, and then you can set your clock November to March when people turn their furnaces on. It's indoor air. So all of those are triggers for asthma. But it's not just that asthma is being noticed more or diagnosed more. There is a definite increase in asthma, and there are several theories for that.
Carl Brooks, Region 7 covers Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Iowa. How does our air quality compare to other parts of the United States?
It's getting better. The point that Caroline made about our larger industrial cities being places where air quality is still a challenge is exactly right. If you take a look at an air quality map here of the Heartland, you can really zoom in on places like St. Louis, Kansas City, Omaha, to some extent Des Moines. These are all cities that have substantial concentrations of industry. As Caroline said, there are substantial concentrations of commuters. Most of our big heartland cities are also pretty spread out, and they don't have super strong public transportation, so you see quite a lot of vehicle miles traveled. And again, because we're a crossroads in the country, you have huge numbers of rail and truck freight passenger miles moving through here. All of those contribute to air quality challenges that we see most obviously in bigger cities. There's also a side to this where people who live near major transportation corridors and people who live in economically disadvantaged neighborhoods, they definitely carry a heavier load. That's sure true in both Kansas City and St. Louis and Omaha. Those in some ways who can least afford the health costs or the property damage are the ones who take the biggest burden.
I'm thinking about the irony of the double doozy of the coal train. You've got the emissions from the coal, from the locomotive carrying the coal or pulling the coal, and then you've got the emissions from coal plants themselves. And we'll get to a little bit more on that a little bit later. But so, you know, Kansas City, not the largest city in the U.S., but we have some of the same problems as larger cities. What issues do even larger cities or other parts of the country face that we don't? And I guess I'm thinking about the coast and things like acid rain.
Sure. I'll take a stab at that, and Caroline probably can go forward from there. Coastal cities will have issues with wind patterns that can sock pollution in there. Other cities that are up in the mountains, I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest, so you look at places like Salt Lake City, Denver, my hometown of Boise, Idaho, they have really serious weather challenges in the middle of the winter because of a climatic feature where you get a lot of cold, dense air trapped in the mountain valleys that just hold on to pollution. Anybody who's traveled into Denver in the winter and seen the brown cloud can definitely relate to what I'm talking about there.
Is clean air an issue in rural areas of Region 7 or of our country? I mean, is it as big of a deal as it is in Kansas City, Professor Davies?
Well, in rural areas, you might have a lot of agriculture, and there's a fair amount of dust associated with that. You also have, in Kansas, burning. When you do massive burning, that also contributes to poor air quality. And then you get into the concept of cross-state.
Sure.
So, particulates that are generated somewhere else, anywhere downwind, is going to be subject to that. The New England and Canada suffer from the acid rain because they're downwind of us. Anything that's coming from Denver, from other places, we will also, even the burning in Kansas, will come into Kansas City and affect our air quality.
Hmm. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Stephen Steigman. Our guests are Carl Brooks. He's the regional administrator for Region 7 of the EPA. And Caroline Davies, she's the program director for UMKC's Environmental Studies Program. We're discussing the Clean Air Act, climate change, and ecological challenges we face. Kansas City, how important is clean air to you? Would you be willing to pay to have cleaner air? And what is it worth to you? Do you have any questions about the Clean Air Act or climate change? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. What does the Clean Air Act mean for the auto industry? Carl Brooks?
Sure, Stephen. One of the real advances that this agency has made over the last 4 years is working with the car and the truck industry, as well as with heavy equipment manufacturers like Deere and Caterpillar, to really step up the vehicle efficiency of these engines. During President Obama's administration, EPA, working with the transportation sector, has put in place mileage standards that will take the average miles per gallon for a car or a light truck that we drive from about the mid-20s up to almost 55 miles per gallon by the year 2025. We've done much the same thing with the truck industry. We're about to undertake some new improvements on heavy and medium-duty truck energy efficiency. What this means, Stephen, is real savings for people. We're expecting that these improvements in engines will save nearly $2 trillion out of people's pocketbook in fuel they don't have to buy and fuel for businesses that they don't have to buy. And it also cuts greenhouse gases. When you have a more efficient engine, you're just not emitting the kinds of pollutants that cause greenhouse gases. So transportation sector has been a really good collaborative partner with the EPA, and we are very proud of these. These are basically historic, precedent-setting improvements that we have obtained working with the auto industry over the last 3 or 4 years.
How does the oil industry feel about these regulations?
Well, I cannot speak for any one particular industry, Stephen. I can't say
On the
that.
Phone with us now, the spokesperson from Chevron. Just kidding. Go ahead.
Yeah. I suspect that since the oil industry is responsible for supplying motor fuel, they're in favor of almost anything that allows their product to be used more efficiently. One of the great things that we see right now in the United States is this real good synergy between the fuel sector, the utility sector, the transportation sector, and the appliance sector, too, all kind of driving each other to make improvements in efficiency. Engineers kind of inventing new processes. It's one of the reasons we're optimistic about improving the way we generate electricity is there's just a really good synergy going on right now to make our energy system smarter, cleaner, and greener.
Now, did it take a long time to get companies like this to work together and to cooperate? I mean, did it take a bit of persuasion to get them to do things that you might not think they would do? Professor Davies?
Sure. Sure. Changing corporate mindsets is challenging. And here in this area, major lawsuits have taken place. But since then, KCP&L, the business community, the banks, the car industry are, in fact, collaborating with the city and developing all kinds of green solutions.
How do regulations from the Clean Air Act, what do they mean for ordinary folks like you and me? I'm thinking of things like, you know, CFCs, emissions from lawnmowers, spray paint, burning leaves. I don't own a power plant. I drive a relatively fuel-efficient car. But what other sections of the Clean Air Act influence what I do? Carl?
Stephen, this is one of the perspectives that you introduced early on. Everybody lives inside of a house or an apartment, so that steps that we take with local building councils and steps that we take with local governments are designed to make the indoor air that all of us breathe healthier. I'd say really anybody who drives or turns on a computer in the morning, plugs in their iPod, everybody really is affected by the way that we balance the efficiency of our energy system against public health protection. And it's always a balance. This agency is instructed by the Clean Air Act to find that appropriate balance between the science that we know and the way our economy functions best, which is through private initiative. And I think we generally do a good job here at the EPA on finding that balance.
Professor Davies, it sounds like the EPA does a fine job with industries. How about with individuals? Do you think we've yet changed the behavior of individuals?
No. And we can talk about coal-fired power plants and should we have them and should we make them more efficient and energy delivery systems more efficient, and we can talk all about the energy and technology side, but what we really haven't addressed on a very large scale is changing human consumption habits.
Expand on that. Tell me about a typical consumption of electricity that people don't think about.
Well, all the kinds of things that we do that put CO2 into the atmosphere, from all the technology we use, your cell phones, your computers are manufactured, we drive. Kansas City, in particular, is famous for all the miles we drive. We don't live, play, work, shop in the same location. We drive around a lot and just consuming. We can't continue to consume the way we are now. And it's really hard to change people's behavior on a large scale. If you look nationally, we got people to put on seatbelts. That was a big behavior modification transition. We got people to stop smoking.
But this took a really long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many more years do you think it will be before the average person turns off their computer instead of letting it hibernate, or unplugs their phone charger when they're not using it, or, you know, powers down, you know, any number of electronics that consume electricity constantly, even when they're not, quote unquote, on? How long do you think that'll take?
Well, how long do we have before there are the recent reports that are coming out just in the last month, the new IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, there's a new paper in Nature on just exactly when the timing of increased warming is going to affect the tropics in 7 years. This is not something that's going to happen 50 years from now. We're in the midst of it. It's already happening. So how do you get large-scale behavior modification?
Stephen, if I could just...
Please, go right ahead, please.
...is a really important point. If you take a look at who Americans value and who they pay attention to, scientists and researchers are among the most valued sources of information people have, so that as these eminent scientists who've dedicated their lives to understanding these processes share the results of their research, Americans notice that. I mean, that's one of the reassuring things about this discussion that we're in the midst of at EPA about carbon pollution, and that is that Americans get the fact that we have an obligation to do something with this research. We simply don't want it to, you know, sit on the computer. We want to act on it. That's one of the reasons why so many people are interested in coming to share their views with the EPA is they recognize that the science is in. We know what the consequences are of climate change, and we know that we have a chance to make a difference in our lifetimes. And we have an obligation to make it for our kids and our kids beyond them.
Let's take a call from Carrie in Kansas City, Missouri. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. I wanted your guest to expound on the pollutants from open burning Combustion of any organic materials, as they know, creates polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These are extremely...
Whoa, Carrie, dumb that down for me. What does that mean?
These polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are generated by the burning of any organic material that could be planned burns in Kansas that they spoke of. It could also be the allowed burning of yard waste in Wyandotte County. When they confront water vapor, they convert to benzene, a well-known potent carcinogen. And there is a trend in my part of the city and other parts of the city cores to encourage what are called recreational fires, where everyone has a fire pit,
yes,
an outdoor oven, and these really ought to be recognized as recreational pollutants.
Hmm. Carl Brooks, what about Carrie's question? What should we not use fire pits?
One of the primary responsibilities that local governments have, and it's a responsibility that the Kansas City area is generally pretty good at, is in managing in a responsible way these small sources of air pollution. There isn't, for example, a federal permit system for a backyard fire or for somebody's chimenea out on the patio. I strongly suspect there won't be. And that's really a place where local government, using its, really long-term powers to manage nuisances and to protect public health, has the lead role. So a city like Kansas City, Missouri, or the caller mentioned Wyandotte County, those are places that have adequate authority under the Clean Air Act and their own municipal powers to regulate those sources if they are a nuisance and if they're a public health threat.
Professor Davies, what about that? Do you think the average person recognizes what their backyard chimenea or fire pit contributes to?
No. And we're generally not aware of our driving miles, and many of our activities. Again, this gets back to behavioral modification. And lots of people are doing little things here and there. Recycling. You see more and more people taking their bags to the grocery store. But we need large-scale changes to address these kinds. Mowing your lawn, not filling up your gas during ozone days. And you see a lot of that with the city. During the summer, you see alerts for ozone. It's on the radio.
Yep.
It's on the buses. And people are beginning to know that when you see that, stay indoors, don't drive, don't fill up your gas. So more community knowledge.
Hmm. Carrie, thanks so much for the call today. I really appreciate it. Are environmental laws hard to enforce, Carl Brooks?
Not necessarily, Stephen. Again, back to the idea that the Clean Air Act has been one of this country's best and smartest investments in public health and competitiveness. Surveys show people agree that we have a responsibility to keep the air healthy, that we owe a responsibility to our kids and our descendants to leave them the opportunities that we had. So when it comes to the basic, you might say, trust and respect that this agency has among the people we work for, it's really high. The agency works closely with state agency partners. Kansas and Missouri, for example, both have strong state environmental agencies. That's where a lot of the day-to-day, what you might consider the sort of pick-and-shovel work of enforcement comes in. It's been our experience here at Region 7 that when the facts of an air quality violation are presented to a company or to an individual, we're almost always able to work with the state partner and with that firm or that individual to come to some resolution. And we've just seen a really strong commitment on the part of people in this region to the fundamental idea that healthy air is one of our responsibilities as citizens to provide to each other and to provide to the future.
What's part of that resolution? Are there repercussions? Do fines occur? What happens here in a typical case?
It can cover a whole range, Stephen, from dollar fines that a violator of a permit would have to pay to agreements to change technology, to use different practices inside the factory or at the facility, to simple agreements not to do it again. It depends on the facts of each case And generally, when a business or an individual has a permit under the Clean Air Act, they understand that permit is the equivalent, you might say, of a driver's license. And, you know, most people follow the rules of the road when they drive. Most companies with permits follow the rules of the permit. When they don't, they recognize that there was a reason for it, and we've generally had good luck working with the state partners to enforce those permits under the Air Quality Act.
Hmm. Who are the go ahead, Professor.
There are other positive non-enforcement kinds of ways to change, and because climate links to many different aspects of our lives, food is another one. Our food to grocery stores traditionally travels long distances. It's grown in other countries, creating all kinds of mileage associated with food. And so in Kansas City, we have a very vibrant, active urban gardening and urban farming. And that's very much a part of not only health, but reducing carbon. So organizations like Cultivate KC, fabulous organization, and this is really taking off in Kansas City, and it's wonderful. And working with the city codes departments to change codes in order to facilitate this kind of farming in the urban core. And that actually helps with climate.
Hmm. Every little bit helps, I suppose. Let's say hi to 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us, centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's say hi to Julie in Pleasant Hill, Missouri. Julie, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking my call. And as a fellow federal employee, I'm interested in partnering and thankful for our partnership with the EPA and with the Department of Commerce, in particular the National Weather Service. And I appreciate our partnerships with academia and Professor Davis as well as Director Brooks for, you know, trying to help with the outreach program, not only for individual mindset change, but my question really is about how do we handle sort of the onslaught from different organizations. You know, one that comes to mind is Governor Perry of Texas and his desire and others' desire to actually eliminate agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency. And so what measures are being undertaken to help combat and that kind of an onslaught of calling for the elimination of such an important agency?
Carl Brooks, can you comment on that, or would you prefer to stay away from the political question right there?
Well, I'll stay clear of the politics, except to say that the best argument for EPA is the record of our work. I mean, the dedicated people who work for the region here in the heartland, I think that the effects of what they do are understood and accepted and really appreciated by 15 million folks here. We're proud of the work we do. We think we're a vital part of a good life here in the Midwest. We strive every day to do our jobs better. We welcome constructive criticism. One reason we're having this listening session is to get a bunch of different ideas. But, you know, I certainly appreciate Julie's point that there are critics of this agency. They tend to kind of flourish during even-numbered years. We understand that's just the nature of American politics and American democracy, is you got critics on all sides. Our best response is to do a good job, and I think we do a really fine job here in Region 7.
Hmm. Julie, thanks. Thank you for the call. Let's talk about one of the major contributors to carbon emissions in this area, in fact, the entire country, how most Missourians and Kansans get their power, coal-fired power plants. Professor Davis, are these plants cleaner now than they were a decade ago?
Some of them are cleaner now than they were a decade ago. We have many that are old plants, and we have large percentages that need to be upgraded, but certainly the technology is getting better and better. Am I an advocate of coal-fired power plants? No, but we're not going to turn the lights off tomorrow.
Hmm.
We need energy, but we also have to be going forward with alternative energies as we continue to make the technology for this existing energy. And for me, I see it not as a debate about power plants, but that keeps us in the fossil fuel energy internal combustion engine mode. And so all the time we focus on that, we are not focusing energy, dollars, resources, innovation to alternatives.
Hmm. Carl Brooks, tell us about some of the technologies that coal-fired power plants are using now that they might not have, let's say, one or two decades ago.
Sure. You know, Stephen, there's a whole suite of technologies that coal-burning power plants have adopted over the last 10, 15, even 20 years. I mean, one of the strengths of the Kansas City area, real frankly, is we have world-class engineering firms here like Black & Veatch, Burns & McDonnell, others, that provide advice and engineering guidance to some of the most sophisticated power-generating firms, both in North America and globally. And many of the kinds of innovations that Caroline was referencing are ones that engineers from these firms have worked with their power sector customers to install. Scrubbers are a classic example.
Tell us about what is a scrubber?
Well, again, not being an engineer either, I'm going to generally
give us the basic one here.
Sure. It's a device that uses a combination of an electrical current and then pieces of technology like filters to capture certain kinds of pollutants before they leave the stacks of a coal-fired power plant. It's not cost-free. It does require its own power to operate. The returns, though, in terms of pollutants eliminated can be really substantial. And a number of newer plants and larger plants here in this part of the Midwest have adopted scrubbing technology. Caroline's point is accurate. It's generally the smaller, older parts of the coal fleet that don't have these new efficient technologies. In many cases, they just don't pencil out economically. So some of what the EPA has been trying to do with the utility industry in the four states here, as well as with our state agency partners, is to focus on plans that allow companies to withdraw and eventually power down these small, old, heavier polluting plants in favor of newer, more modern plants that are capable of supporting good, strong pollution control technology.
Have any permits been granted for coal-fired power plants in Missouri or Kansas with new technologies in the last couple of years? I mean, I'm thinking specifically about Holcomb, Kansas, and of course the Holcomb 2, which went through a big political battle first, and then ultimately was not built. But have there been permits issued for coal burning power plants in the last couple of years?
Yes, there have, primarily on the Missouri side of the line. But this, you pointed out in the opening to this segment, Stephen, that coal is a substantial part of the energy mix, especially for electricity here in this part of the country, especially in Missouri. Kansas has been able to introduce quite a bit more wind over the last 5 years, but I think Caroline's point is accurate. Coal will endure as a baseload power source on the electricity side of things for decades to come, I suspect. I'm not a fortune teller, but we've got a great deal invested in it, and coal will continue in our part of the country to be a substantial contributor to electricity. The challenge for the EPA and our state agency partners and for the utility sector is to design those plants so that they can be modified over time to apply new pollution control technologies, ranging from the type of fuel they use to the way it's burned to the way that the emissions are captured and managed.
I assume power companies are interested in efficiency, but are they interested in, quote, clean coal power? I mean, how does it help their bottom line?
Well, I'd say that the primary question about so-called clean coal technology is whether it's scalable up to a large facility size. There's a number of really promising experiments that are going on at private sector coal plants in other parts of the Midwest. Our partner agency, the Department of Energy, has a program designed to promote research and application of clean coal technology. One of the goals of the EPA's carbon pollution standards is to encourage new coal plants to adopt clean coal strategies, and there are a whole bunch of different technologies that can do that. There's not just one out-of-the-box solution to make a clean coal plant. There's a variety of different ways you can design and operate it, and we're encouraging that with a set of rules that we're introducing for new coal plants.
What's in those rules? Give us the very basics.
Sure. We are in the process of looking towards spring of next year, having standards in place for new coal-fired plants. The basic goal here is to make them more successful in eliminating carbon pollution, especially carbon dioxide, One of the ways that the agency is encouraging that is through the use of carbon capture and sequestration. Kind of goes by the acronym CCS. It's a technology that has a lot of different parts to it. There's no one out-of-the-box solution, but it appears to be clear that companies building plants of a certain size can use this CCS technology and still meet all of their Clean Air Act obligations under the Federal Clean Air Act as well as their state permits.
Tell us once again about the upcoming meeting that you've got going on at the EPA.
Sure, gladly. On Monday, November 4, between 4 p.m. and 8 p.m. here at our regional office, which is in Lenexa, just off Renner Boulevard, we are encouraging all kinds of members of the public, citizens, organizations, members of the utility sector, to come in and share their perspectives with the EPA as we decide how to make rules for existing coal-fired power plants. That's really the effort now, is to try to get the greatest greenhouse gas reductions from the greatest source of greenhouse gas, and that is existing coal plants. We have a website. People who want to testify at this hearing can speak briefly at it, and they can submit comments by email if they don't want to trek on out here to Lenexa.
We'll put that information on our website at kcur.org. That's Carl Brooks. He's the regional administrator for Region 7 of the EPA. Carl Brooks, thanks so much for being with us today.
Stephen, you're very welcome. It's a real pleasure. Thanks.
Caroline Davies is the program director for UMKC's Environmental Studies program. Caroline, thank you so much for being
here. Welcome. I would encourage everyone to go to the meeting.
Thanks for that good advice. We're going to go out for a short break, but when we return, we'll explore the small town of Overbrook, Kansas, as a case study for the state of small towns throughout the United States. Central Standard returns in just a moment.